I've written a column for the latest issues, etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org. We are all confused. We're pretty sure that half of what we read about the pandemic is not true, maybe not completely false, but not completely true. We don't know who to trust. We do not know what to do. Do I wear a mask? Do I go out? Do I have to stay in my house all the time? Or can I go out and just practice that social distancing? How important is open democracy, open markets, a free press, and a free flow of information, and finally, trust in battling coronavirus? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to get an update on the global pandemic, Lyman Stone. He's senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod. Lyman, welcome back.
Good to be here.
What countries have engaged the pandemic the best and why?
I think we've seen the most successful responses in Taiwan, Korea, and Hong Kong. Taiwan had a very effective travel ban that they imposed very early on. Korea had an extraordinarily extensive program of testing and tracing that they ran very effectively. And Hong Kong has had something more like population-level resistance, where people have just really taken it on themselves to take the appropriate measures to control the disease. So different strategies, but all three have had really successful responses.
How would you rate the U.S. response so far?
So far, pretty poor. At every level of leadership, policymakers have been slow to act, and when they act, they have not acted to implement the most effective policies. Communication has been mixed. It's waffled between sort of an inhumane economy first perspective and a panicking, we have to shut everything down or else we're all going to die perspective. And I mean, we can simply see in U.S. death tolls that our response has not been highly effective.
Are the numbers that are coming out of China reliable? I'm talking about reported by the World Health Organization, just under 84,000 confirmed cases. And if you go to Worldometer, they'll give you about 82,000 confirmed cases.
I wouldn't call them reliable, no. China has a lot of idiosyncrasies in how they report their data. Some of this is good faith idiosyncrasies. That is, it's just an administrative difference in how they report their data. But some of it is not in good faith. Some of this is places where China has been intentionally suppressing data to try and make themselves look good. So I don't think we should take Chinese data on this at this point with any particular degree of credibility or seriousness.
What data are we missing as we attempt to analyze the pandemic in real time, Lyman?
So the main thing we really need is a reliable estimate of all deaths on a very frequent basis. And CDC is trying to provide this. However, a lot of U.S. states are very slow to, because death reporting is done at the state level, and a lot of U.S. states are simply very slow to collect this data. Their vital statistics, their health agencies simply don't have a sense of urgency. This is actually one of the main problems in the U.S.'s response is lack of a sense of urgency, is a sense that we'll get to it when we get to it. But pandemics don't wait for you to be ready. So a big problem we have is we just don't know how many people are dying. And it's not how many people are dying of COVID. That's not such an important number, actually, because there's lots of classification problems and how you really count a death of COVID. We just want to know how many people died of anything. Is there a big death spike or not? Now, the places that do have rapid reporting, like New York and New Jersey, suggest there's been a very large death spike. Deaths in New York are running at about double what they normally run at this time in the year. It's a much bigger death spike than September 11th, for example. but I don't think that, most states really take this issue very seriously. And this is an important next step.
Many have confused lockdowns with social distancing. What's the difference between the two, and why is that difference so important?
So I would say that lockdowns generally have three characteristics. First is that you're ordered to stay home, or you're required to give an explanation for why you're leaving your house, right? So there's actually a stay-at-home order of some kind in place. Second is they ban assemblies above a very low threshold. So like banning assemblies over 50 people is not really a lockdown, right? Whereas banning assemblies over 5 people kind of is, right? If it's paired with other things. And third is that they involve forced cancellations of a large number of businesses. So they just say, sorry, your business is closed, tough cookies. So if you've got those three characteristics, stay-at-home orders, low-threshold assembly bans, and closures of many businesses, I would say you're in a lockdown. But there's a lot of stuff that we would call social distancing that is not about lockdowns at all. Things like we say, okay, restaurants can stay open, but only 4 people to a table, and you've got to have 10 feet between each table. That's not a lockdown. The business stays open. You have to change how you do business. You're socially distancing. You're putting distance. But this is not a lockdown. Telling a church you can't have Easter services because no more than 5 people can gather, that's kind of a lockdown. But telling churches you can have services as long as there's 10 feet between every family and everyone wears a mask and you have a detailed individual level roster of everyone who comes in and you have to record everyone's temperature as they come in, that's not a lockdown. That's social distancing. Yes, it's hard, but it's a necessary precaution. Telling people you can't have a picnic in the park because we have to keep out of public spaces is a lockdown. Telling people if you're in the park, you need to be wearing a mask is social distancing, right? So there is some gray area between these. There's a lot of evidence that social distancing works. There's not a lot of evidence that lockdowns work. So I'm very much in favor of social distancing. I think it's very important. And a lot of social distancing measures are going to be very draconian and very unpopular. Requiring masks is going to be very unpopular, especially once it gets into the hot, humid summer months and people want to go jogging and you tell them you have to wear a mask while you're jogging. That's not going to be popular, but we need to do it. But lockdowns, where we enforce these things, require people to stay home, force businesses to close, where we simply make no allowance for voluntary compliance, that's too far, and there's also not really any evidence that this actually helps anything.
Why do you think that the policy of quarantining households together at home may be a mistake?
The first reason, as I said, there's just not a lot of evidence that it achieves anything. This is not something that we've like tested many times and have a lot of data on. It's just kind of an idea that China came up with, and they just did, and then people said, oh, China did it, let's do it. It turns out that what research we have out of China suggests that this policy didn't really work. China did not succeed in getting the reproductive rate of the disease below the rate at which, so what we say is below 1. That means below the rate at which the disease will naturally continue to spread exponentially. They didn't get the reproductive rate below that threshold until they moved to what's called centralized quarantine. That is, they stopped quarantining people in their house, and they started quarantining people in central locations. That was the policy that actually worked. But everyone's all into lockdown now. Lockdown is like the sexy thing that we have to do, even though it doesn't really work. The reason I think it doesn't work is because there's just not a lot of evidence for it. If you look at total deaths from all causes in Sweden, they're very similar in terms of their spike to other Nordic countries, even though Sweden didn't do a lockdown. If you look at total death spike in the Netherlands, which didn't do a lockdown, it's very similar to what it is in Belgium, which did do a lockdown. I just don't believe that this sort of dramatic final step has any effect.
What about the possibility that quarantining in the home with family members will simply tend to spread the virus among the family?
Yeah, so that's a very significant risk. In Iceland, for example, where they've had a really extensive test and trace program, we found that now a majority of new cases are spreading within the home. They're spreading within families. It's also possible that this disease may have what we call a viral load factor. That is, it may be that the disease becomes more severe if your initial exposure to it involves a larger amount of viral particles, basically, which is to say that intense exposure may be more dangerous than modest exposure. This is a very technical way of saying being stuck in a house with repeated exposure to a potentially sick person may make cases a lot more severe than if your initial exposure is just like a one-off encounter with a few germs because you passed someone in the grocery store. So it's possible that home-based infections are more severe. Now, we don't have tons of evidence on that. That's sort of speculation, but it is possible. But beyond this, yeah, I mean, close personal contact is how this disease spreads for the most part, so home-based quarantine really poses a lot of risks.
Lyman Stone is our guest. We're getting an update on the global coronavirus pandemic. He's senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies. When we come back, he thinks lockdowns don't reduce deaths and don't necessarily hurt the economy as much as people think. We'll find out why. I've written a column for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The world around us raises all sorts of reasons why Christ could not have risen from the dead. The April issue of the Lutheran Witness discusses how we can, in fact, know that Christ rose from the dead. Adam Francisco answers resurrection objections. Kirk Clayton explains how the Bible proves Christ's resurrection, and there's so much more. Here, Lutherans have an opportunity. For a world focused on fear of death and COVID-19, we can point them to the resurrected Christ. To learn more about this, visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Holy Cross Evangelical Lutheran Church, Albany, Oregon, is amid Willamette Valley LCMS congregation where the liturgy lives and God's people worship as one, with sound biblical doctrine, weekly communion, and a clear confession of Christ crucified for the sin of the world. Please join us at 2515 Queen Avenue Southeast or visit our website at www.HolyCrossLutheranAlbany.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting an update on the global pandemic and the numbers that are having so many of us completely confused all day long. Lyman Stone is our guest, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. Lyman, you recently tweeted, "My suspicion is actually, one, lockdowns don't reduce deaths a lot, and also, two, lockdowns don't hurt the economy that much. Make your case."
So I've already talked about the lack of death reduction, right? There just isn't evidence for it. We can look at cases with lockdowns and without. And again, don't look at COVID deaths. There's lots of reporting biases there. We want to look at all causes of death. And what we can see is just places with lockdowns, there's just no difference in deaths among places with lockdowns and places that don't have lockdowns. So there just isn't evidence there. But the economic side is more interesting, right? People say, well, the lockdowns are destroying the economy. Where's the evidence? Sweden is having a massive economic downturn too. The Netherlands is having a massive economic downturn too. Restaurant reservations in the U.S. had already fallen by 90% before states went into lockdowns, before shelter-in-place orders were issued. Airlines are not locked down, and yet airline traffic has fallen by over 90%. You look at any business, even if it's not legally restricted, demand for it has plummeted. Why? Because people are taking the disease seriously, as they should. You should take it seriously. You should love your neighbor and protect them from unnecessary infection and risk of death. This is a basic commandment issue, and people are taking it seriously. And so it doesn't matter if you do a lockdown or not. If all of your trade partners are locked down, and if all of your people are protecting themselves, whatever law you put on the books doesn't matter. People aren't going to be going to the movie theater. They're just not going to. So I don't think that the economic effects of lockdowns are going to turn out to be very significant. I think once you've got basic social distancing measures, once you've got school canceled, once you've got a handful of these things, the additional economic burden of the lockdown is minuscule. All you're really doing is you're just harassing people. You're just causing annoyance, and you're just creating a lot of bureaucracy and police work.
You have said the entire focus of policy should be on finding ways to create social mobilization and cooperative activity to prevent epidemic spread. This doesn't just mean lockdowns. What do you mean?
So epidemics are intensely local things. We think of them on this global scale, but they're actually not. They're about who you contact. They're about the precautions you take for yourself and your family. They're about whether you wear a mask when you're potentially infected or not. They're about whether you wash your hands. They're about whether you make the choice to reduce your social activity or not. This is something that the government can write whatever laws it wants, but if people don't work together to protect one another, those laws will fail. You can tell people that they have to shelter in place, but if they keep sneaking out to hang out with each other, they'll continue to have epidemic spread, right? So what we actually have to beat this is cooperation on a society-wide scale. We need a genuine social commitment to protecting one another, to being our neighbor's keeper, especially our vulnerable neighbors. This means that government policies really need to focus on providing people accurate information about risks and risk mitigation, which means any public official who gets on TV without wearing a mask is doing a terrible thing. Every public official should always be wearing a mask anytime there's a camera. They need to communicate the severity of the issue and how to respond to it. You respond to respiratory droplet spread diseases by wearing masks. It's that simple. Always wear a mask. So that's one thing. But you also, you need to focus not just on punitive things, not just on banning things, but requiring things. Don't ban people from going to the store. Require one-way flow through aisles in the store, right? Let people shop, but just require them to go only one direction through the store, right? This means no one passes each other, so there's dramatically reduced risk of infection, right? So basic things like this help to create awareness. They help to make people aware of the problem, and they help to make people feel empowered that they can be part of the solution. And that feeling of empowerment is important because we are going to be doing various social distancing measures for months, or if it turns out to be much harder to develop effective treatments and vaccines than we think, years. We could be doing this a long time, which means we need to be adopting policies that people can continue doing for a very long time. So I think we need to be thinking about this not in terms of how can we get through these hard 3 weeks. We need to be thinking about this in terms of how can we mobilize society to the kind of sort of total war commitment that is necessary to beat the Nazis or beat the communists or beat COVID, because that is what it's going to be. It's going to be months or years of whole life commitment.
Are political leaders largely failing to distinguish between urban and rural populations in their lockdown orders?
You know, I think that there is an issue here where we've got pretty blanket policies that aren't dealing with different kinds of residential environments, but it's not quite a question of rural or urban, right? It's a question of crowding. But there are some very rural places that are crowded, right? So one of the largest outbreaks in America right now is actually in a rural area that happens to have a pork processing facility where people are very crowded while they're at work, right? So it is a problem of crowding, but it's not quite a problem of urbanness. Within New York City, the main predictor of infections at the zip code level is not population density, it's average household size. So it's how many people are living in the house. It's crowding. So what we really are interested here is crowding at work and at home, not population density per se. So if people have very spacious, airy, well-ventilated, sunny environments at work, in transportation, at play, and at home, then that's probably a reasonably safe environment where we might not need as draconian of measures. But if they have a very crowded environment, it's different. And many urban environments may have more crowded environments, but some rural areas may have crowded workplaces and substandard housing accommodations as well.
Why were countries like Spain, Italy, France hit so hard?
There's a variety of reasons. Almost half of the deaths in most of those countries are in assisted living and nursing home facilities. So a lot of what you're seeing is just what happens when these diseases break into old age populations where there's a high potential for spread. So that's part of what you're seeing. It's possible also in Italy, it looks like some of the early cases may have been related to migrant workers connected to China. Italy has a very large population of Chinese workers. Spain, I'm not sure about early cases. Again, epidemics are very local things. Explaining national level differences is very hard because you can have one gathering at an opportune moment that creates a massive outbreak. In France, a large missions and evangelism conference was one of the big early outbreaks. I'm not sure what it was in Spain. So there's idiosyncratic events that are just very hard to predict in these like big national level aggregate models.
When we come back, how important is open democracy, open markets, a free press, and a large capital of social trust? We're talking about the pandemic with Lyman Stone. Stay tuned.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Casting Christ's net on the internet. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Christ has shed his blood for me, gave himself into death for my sake. Why should I not also subject myself to a little danger for his sake? What need to regard a powerless pestilence, where you can terrify, my Christ can strengthen, where you can kill, my Christ can give life, where you have poison on your lips, Christ has far more medicine. A prayer of one who because of his duties cannot flee in time of pestilence. From the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Lutheran Prayer Companion. It's at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House for this great prayer resource, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. We're talking about the pandemic and the confusion that all the numbers and miscalculations are causing us. Lyman Stone is our guest. Lyman, you have said that open democracy, open markets, a free press, and a large capital of social trust are indispensable during the pandemic. Why?
So as I said, we will defeat this pandemic with population-level resistance. That is, where the entire population commits to taking essential basic procedures to dramatically reduce their risk. That requires free flow of information, because at the get-go, we don't know what the best procedures are, right? We don't know what it is on day one. We still don't know exactly what the best strategy will be. We don't know what cures work best. We don't know exactly what kind of preventative treatments may be available. The only way we get to know is by people talking about it, is by researchers being able to freely share and debate their ideas. So the free flow of information is vital. good information flow means that we can see when an epidemic, when we have an outbreak in an area, and we can respond quickly. And then when it stops, we can maybe ease open, and we can have a few weeks that are closer to normalcy. Not completely normal, but closer. So the free flow of information is vital. The free flow of information is contingent on and related to democracy, right? Any democracy requires that people be able to get information and make decisions about their leadership. And if you can get information to make a decision about your leadership, chances are you are living in a democracy. Open markets are also important. Centrally controlled markets do not respond well to these kinds of extreme supply shocks. What we need are open markets where people can buy and sell freely and where markets can respond dynamically and look for supplies even in disrupted times. And what we're seeing is that global supply chains are responding very well under very taxing conditions. The places where they aren't, in like Ecuador or the Philippines or India, are overwhelmingly places that have highly regulated agricultural markets that kind of thwart market signals, that make it very difficult for the market to provide for food for people. And so they're having food security issues. But as long as we maintain essentially an open and functional market, we will get through this. There's another reason why I don't think it's good to close businesses arbitrarily. And finally, social trust is so important. We need to have an ethos of mutual care. We need to be looking around and saying, how can I help and serve my neighbor? How can I be of benefit to my neighbor? How can I love my neighbor? How can I protect my neighbor? How can I be my neighbor's keeper? Right? This is something as Lutherans that should be very natural to us. This is how we communicate sort of our moral vision in the catechism anyways, is about, of course, we fear and love God so that we do all these things in the second table of law, at least all these things in relation to our neighbor, as we elaborate on loving our neighbor as ourself. So this should be very natural to us, but this requires a degree of social trust. It requires, because we are ultimately selfish and sinful beings, it requires that we have a credible belief that our neighbor is going to care for us too. And I think it's worth mentioning, you know, I don't want to lean too heavily on this, but I think there's something too. A lot of the European countries that have the highest rates of social trust are overwhelmingly Lutheran places, historically at least, right? Like Iceland, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, parts of Germany. These are places where our spiritual heritage is a huge part of the historical culture that informs a sense of togetherness and trust and solidarity that in a time of crisis is exceptionally important. You know, just today, a friend who runs a confessional Lutheran podcast in Germany sent me a translation of some plague protocols that were put in place in Wittenberg in the 17th century. It's a fascinating read because it's a joint document by the government officials and the church officials to come up with a humane set of rules to prevent the spread of plague within the city. It's an interesting read how they tried to handle this. There's some smart ideas. There's some that, looking back, weren't so great. But this was something very natural to our spiritual tradition to try and look out for each other like this. They provided for the poor in times of plague out of the public coffers. They believed that this was important. So social trust, free flow of information, a sense of mutual solidarity, and the access to functioning markets are so important in disruptive times. And that's why ultimately I believe open and democratic systems have succeeded throughout history. We have become a larger share of nations around the world, not because of any warm, fuzzy, touchy-feelies, but because our system is simply superior, because it actually responds better, because it succeeds in mobilizing people. Whereas in China, their system is fraying. It is straining under the pressure. Iran, too. Iran is really struggling with this. So I would say our system is really well-suited to deal with this in the long run. Yes, people are going to die, but the system is going to come out intact.
So in that vein, Lyman, although the ongoing political unrest in Hong Kong predates COVID-19, talk about the positive role that it played in the response to the virus there in Hong Kong.
So social trust is very important. And sometimes that means trust in the government, but often it doesn't. Often it just means trust in the person beside you. And Hong Kongyan have had really an amazing opportunity over the last year to experience social trust on a massive scale as the whole city has risen up in resistance to its government. Even as the approval rating of Hong Kong's government is rock bottom low, there's a sense of what they call Lion Rock spirit, which is this mountain that overlooks the city. But it's a sense that we all go down together. We stand or fall together. We do this together. We have each other's back. You never break ties with each other. This is a slogan they have, never break ties. You never leave anyone behind. So as this epidemic has spread here, people have locked ranks and cared for each other. Serving as a missionary in this community, it has been really powerful to watch a community that we are serving care for each other through thick and thin, through protests and plague, through so many things. Our church, with assembly restrictions and all these things, we had to get creative with our Easter services and exactly what we would do, but we, you know, did our best to comply with all laws, but we put together care packages for people, and our care package was a little Easter card, a little kind of decoration gift thing, and a package of masks, right? This very Hong Kong thing to give for Easter. Our denomination here has centrally purchased large quantities of masks and hand sanitizer to distribute to church members in need. There is a real sense that we're watching out for each other, and it's partly because people here have a real sense that the government is not watching out for them. The government's not going to take care of you, so we have to take care of each other. There's something inspiring about that, about seeing people who are banding together. And I think there's a lot that can be learned from that. And I hope that this crisis will make Americans look at each other in what's been a very divisive few years and say, we are in this together. We are going to live or die together. We have a choice about whether we're going to die alone or whether we're going to live together, whether we will care for our neighbor or not. I hope we choose to care for our neighbor, and I certainly believe that Christians are commanded to do so.
Why is the question, when will government open up the economy, the wrong question, in your opinion?
The economy is not something the government can just flip a switch on. It's not that kind of thing. You can't just decide what GDP is going to be in a year. As I said, even before shelter-in-place orders and cancellation of non-essential services had begun, open table reservations were already down 90%, air traffic was already down 70%, movie theater attendance was already down 60-70%. What we've seen everywhere is that, again, it hardly matters what the rules are, people are staying home. And even if you open up, your trade partners aren't opening up. It just doesn't work. It's just not going to happen. Until the disease is beaten, there are going to be major economic losses. So we should be focusing on strategies to effectively mitigate the disease. That should be the focus. And that means building a real program of social mobilization to create population-level resistance, of widespread behaviors of precaution, care, and protection.
What are your thoughts on President Trump's cutoff of U.S. funding for the World Health Organization?
I think it's barely the beginning of what we need to do to the WHO. The WHO, it is an organization that has wandered so far from its purpose and its function. It needs to be disciplined with extraordinary measures, and it needs to be hauled back to its intended purpose. The World Health Organization is too valuable of an organization to continue to give it a single dime of money without demanding reforms. We should demand that its current director general resign. We should demand that Taiwan be restored to the observer status that it formerly had. We should demand that the WHO modernize its notifiable disease surveillance programs. And we should demand that the WHO be honest about the damaging role of Chinese suppression of information, of communist suppression of information, I should say. Not Chinese, of course. Information wasn't suppressed in Macau, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Malaysia. This isn't a Chinese thing. This is a communist thing. So I'm glad Trump has pulled funding for the WHO. I think he needs to do much more, and he needs to embark on a determined campaign of forcing reform on an organization that desperately needs it.
Can we trust the numbers of confirmed cases and deaths in the U.S.? I'm basically asking, are there reasons why healthcare officials and political leaders might either over or under report the numbers?
There will always be errors. It's hard to generate reliable data this quickly on a new problem. So there will be errors. But in the U.S., these are all good faith errors. These are people honestly trying to give good information and just not always knowing the best way to do it. But what we've seen so far from places that have rapidly reported total death data is that the spikes in total amounts of death are quite similar in total size to reported COVID deaths, which suggests that reported COVID deaths are reasonably accurate. There will be overages and there will be underreporting and it'll vary place by place, but in general terms, it appears from the places where we have early data that COVID deaths are approximately in the vague ballpark of accurate thus far.
Finally then, Lyman, as a demographer, what's the best piece of advice that you can give us on how to understand COVID-19 statistics?
A lot of people are going to die. I mean, I know that that seems extraordinarily simple, but I would say, in my professional opinion, be aware that this is an extraordinarily lethal event without precedent in recent history. It is not just the flu. It is not just a bad flu. It is an extraordinarily dangerous event that is going to kill a large number of people. When I look at demographic data to find peer events for this, I have to go to really extraordinarily disastrous events. So I would say, as you conceptualize it, you should not be thinking of it as just a bad flu. It is a remarkable world historic lethal occurrence.
Lyman Stone is senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies. He's adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod. You can follow Lyman on Twitter at Lyman Stone KY. That's LYMAN Stone KY. Lyman, thank you.
Thank you.
In hour two of Issues, Etc., we're going to talk with a university psychology professor and a Lutheran pastor about psychedelic drugs, their effects, and the spiritual dangers. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
Lutheran Talk.
We have an ecumenical responsibility to hold forth the Scriptures and to bear witness to grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone.
Lutheran Music. Listen anytime, anywhere in 2020 with the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. Download for iPhone, Android, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.